Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Happy New Year and welcome to Speaking of Mysteries. This week's guest is Thomas Parry, who has brought back the popular Jane Whitefield character in A String of Beads. Jane has to be among one of the most unique protagonists in crime fiction. She's a Seneca Indian who helps people disappear by assuming new identities. Of course, there are often other people who would rather she not do this and either try to stop her or find out where the runners, as she calls her clients, have gone. Tom is also the author of one of my favorite mysteries of all time, Metzger's Dog, which was published in 1983. We talk about that book, which Tom said had been one of the easiest novels in his career to write, and how events portrayed in the book, which had seemed like a bit of a lark at the time, now would have more sinister overtones. Even in a world where new crime fiction novels are being written on an almost daily basis, I still recommend Metzger's Dog as a must-read for fans of the genre. When we were chatting after the interview, Tom mentioned that his wife, Jo Parry, had written her first mystery. It is one of the most unique stories I have ever read. I hope to have Jo join us on the podcast to talk about Dead is Better very soon. But for right now, here's Thomas Parry. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries and Happy New Year. This week's guest is Thomas Parry, whose newest Jane Whitefield novel, A String of Beads, is just about to be released. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Nancy.
I'm going to jump right in. All of your central characters of your series are interesting, but at least to me, Jane Whitefield is the most compelling. Her calling, helping people become runners and to reinvent themselves so they can disappear, is fascinating. So thank you for bringing Jane back to her fans. Did you always intend to have her make a comeback?
Well, thanks. She keeps making comebacks. Her original existence was in a book called Vanishing Act. And when I wrote Vanishing Act, I had intended it to be like everything else I'd ever done, which was a standalone. But the problem was that at the end of it, I sort of felt as though I was done with the book, but I hadn't finished with her. And so at a certain point, I started working on another one, and my editor at Random House in those days was Joe Fox, who you may recall was his name was used in the one of those You've Got Mail or one of those things, one of those movies anyway. But he was a wonderful editor, but he did what all editors do, which is if they haven't heard from you for a while, they call you up and say, working on anything? And I said, yeah, you know, I had written that book and I sort of would like to do another one and I'm kind of working on it. And he said, well, all right. And then he called back about an hour or so later and he said, how would you like to make it five? So I said, you know, I had always said that writing series was probably a terrible idea and that it was just something that people do for money. And so when I heard the offer, I said, sure, I'll do it. And so then I finished the fifth one. And then at that point, I decided I was going to go back and write a lot of standalones. And so I did. I sat down and started writing all the standalones that I had sort of thought about while I was writing about Jane. And I started to get emails about, well, where's Jane? What, you know, when is the next Jane book coming out? And each time I would answer the person and say something like, well, I do intend to bring Jane back. I kind of miss her when I'm not writing about her. But right now I have all these other stories I want to tell. And that another person would write, and another, and finally it started to get to the point where half of the emails that I got, including spam, was people asking why there was no Jane Whitefield book. And I realized, I sort of looked at my memory again, and I realized that it had been almost 9 years since I had written the Jane book. And at that point, I started to think about doing it again, and then I finally got the kicker email, which was, you know, people were thinking that I had gotten sort of run out of ideas or something, so they would send me plots for a Jane book. You know, if you can't think of a plot, here's a good plot for a Jane book. And, you know, at that point, I finally got one that said, "Have you retired or are you dead?" So I decided that I probably should write another Jane book. And at that point, I wrote Runner. And a couple of years after that, I wrote Poison Flower. And now it's sort of a routine with me that I don't let Jane lie fallow for too long. I sort of bring her back every once in a while. I give her a rest while I'm writing something else.
You actually don't want to get to a point where it's hashtag where's Jane.
That's right. That's true. But it's funny that, you know, the people like her, and I like her in the same way. I kind of miss her when I'm not writing about her. And so it was fun to write A String of Beads. It was a kind of special experience for me for a lot of reasons. And one of them was that I, for the first time in my career, I managed to have a person who volunteered essentially to be an informant. This wonderful man who was a lawyer, a Canadian lawyer, who essentially does mostly Native American issues on both sides of the border, and is a wonderful man and a generous one, wrote to me. He said, "I've been reading these Jane Whitefield books for about 20 years. By the way, I didn't mention he's a Seneca. Having read these books, I keep thinking I'm going to write to you, and because you, there are a couple of things that it seems to me you don't quite understand about Seneca life." And my ears perked up, and he proceeded to give me all this information, which I've never seen written anywhere before, and which was absolutely wonderfully useful and inspiring. And I wrote back to him, and I thanked him. I said, "This is wonderful stuff. Nobody's ever told me this stuff before." But, you know, what had happened to me really was that, that when I had met Seneca people, they would be very polite and kind about my writings, but I think probably some of them were thinking to themselves, "Gee, I really should tell him that he's got the, you know, he really doesn't understand the way the creation story works," or something like that. You know, but they didn't. And of course, you know, nobody has a responsibility to do that for a writer, but this man did. His name's Paul Williams. He's a wonderful man. And I wrote back to him, and I said, "Well, you know, anything else that you ever think of, please, you know, if you see anything in my books or whatever, please let me know, because, you know, this information's wonderful." And immediately he wrote back. And I, you know, these are long, single-spaced, five-page or so letters, and absolutely full of additional information that was inspiring and interesting really, it was like a strong wind blowing behind me to make me write this book. So I, you know, did give him an acknowledgement in the front of the book, but I haven't heard from him yet on how what he thinks of the new book. So we'll see. We'll have to see.
Well, I think that Jane must be unique among characters. She's a woman protagonist as well as a Seneca. But what strikes me about many of your novels, but specifically about this series, is her identity is such a strong thing for her. Her identity and her sense of duty, they're very important, and they inform her actions in her work and in her life. But what she does, helping people change their identities, you know, not just their names, but also how they dress and conduct themselves, is a curious contrast to who she is. And I'm assuming that this juxtaposition is intentional, that she remains true to herself, but she helps people segue into being somebody else.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing about changing your identity is... well, it's both in the case of these novels, of course, it's a necessity. It's a thing that people only do when they're extremely desperate. But at the same time, it's kind of an opportunity. You get you know, to live, I don't know, 30 or 40 years or whatever it is by the time you find yourself in Jane's hands. And you're faced with a decision. What? Who am I? Who do I want to be? You know, what essentially should I have been? And, you know, what can I do about it? What can I do about it now? Who should I be? And it gives an opportunity to kind of think about, at first, what an identity really is in our society from the outside. In other words, you know, we're all each carrying around this persona that we accidentally or intentionally created. And from the other point of view, what is it that we can do to make our lives rich and valuable? And in this particular case, people who run into Jay and get an opportunity to rethink that, presumably after they're through running. But it is essentially, the Jane books are really about identity. And you know, one of the things that sort of set that off in me originally was I was looking for a new protagonist to write about. I was between novels, and I was sort of watching our kids as they were in the pool and all that stuff, and thinking about how I would like to write a female protagonist, because it seemed to me that by then I was in my 40s and I had been earning a living as a writer for a long time, but I'd never had a woman in the absolute center of a book before. I mean, to some extent, I guess some of my earliest books would give you the impression that the world was, you know, consisted of a bunch of angry men. And
doesn't it? Isn't the world a place full of angry men?
Sometimes it seems that way, but it actually isn't. So I decided that if I tried to do a book with a female protagonist, I would either find that I could do it, or I would make sure that I learned how to do it. And so Jane was part of that. And to some extent, there's over a period of all of the eight books, I get to do an awful lot of thinking about identities and about gender identity, for instance. Jane does an awful lot of things that people don't expect a woman to do. And at the same time, what she's doing is exactly what women do. And she gets to sort of define herself against all of that stuff. She also is very proud, as you say, of her identity and very concerned with it and so on and very aware of it. But at the same time, life, her survival, depends on her ability to mask that or change it or whatever whenever she's working or might be exposed to the people who are the enemies of her clients. I'm referring to them as clients, but in the books she always refers to them as her runners, which I think is a more appropriate term, because she doesn't take money for anything.
Right, she doesn't. She doesn't take compensation for doing it. She seems to evaluate each case on an individual basis.
Right, and there's also that has a root in the in traditional Seneca society too. I mean, among the Iroquois, you wouldn't hire yourself to do out to do something or other. You know, you don't. But you might do extreme and important favors for people whom you consider to be friends. And the response to that is, after you've done the favor for your friend gives you a present. And the present, the presents in Jane's case early in her career happen to be, some of them, very fairly large presents. Like money or whatever. And so it sort of relieved Jane of the question of how does she come up with the money to buy plane tickets for one of her runners or whatever, or to give them enough money to get a start as a new person.
Or to make sure that all the documents have been processed and created and.
Right. Yeah. That actually was part of the genesis of Jane too. That was another part of this, in which I wanted to do something about a character who, it was sort of let's say that what they were doing was illegal, but actually good. And I wanted to think about something that that actually had a practical aspect to it. And then I happened to hear a couple of stories about people who were in that situation. That is, that they had changed their identities and were living in new places and so on because they had stalkers. I sort of began to play with that, and then I realized that there would be people around to serve such people. Put it the crudest sense, it's really not much harder, at least it wasn't in those days, to make a California driver's license than a $20 bill, but it was worth a heck of a lot more money. But in the case of Jane, it's all altruistic. It isn't, I shouldn't say altruistic. She does it because she needs to do something that makes sense to her. And keeping people alive makes sense. You don't need to think up an elaborate justification for keeping someone else alive. I think that's part of what's going on with Jane. She's confronting one of the problems of the modern world. What do you do with yourself? And, if you...
Especially in a world where your digital footprint is immortal. And I'm right. Curious, though, have you met or spoken to anybody who does this sort of thing?
No, I haven't. I don't know that I have. I'll tell you, after I had been writing the Jane books for a number of years, I ran across a book by a journalist. And I honestly, I can't remember his name anymore, but his book was based on the fact that he had, as I had, run across stories of people who were, living under other identities. And he decided he was going, because he was a journalist and probably a lot less lazy than novelists are, he decided to try and actually find some of these people and interview them and talk to them. And so every time he heard anything about such a person, he would kind of try to follow it up and say, look, I'm perfectly trustworthy. I would like to talk to your friend. Here's my card, and here's my personal number and everything. And if you can get this person to talk to me, I'd appreciate it. And over a period of time, he did get a lot of people to talk to him. But it was actually pretty funny. All of the men that he talked to, the most common fantasy or reason why they had taken off was they said because they wanted to go fishing. He ran into them in places like Baja California and places like that where they would be on a boat and. Instead of essentially staying and living up to whatever responsibilities they had found themselves with, they essentially took off and lived this fantasy life. But here's the part that's actually interesting and serious. Every time that he made an appointment with a woman who had taken off and was living under another identity, she stood him up. He never got to actually talk to any of them.
Maybe women have a little bit more serious reason for wanting to get away from their previous lives than going fishing.
Exactly. And when you think about that, not only is it chilling, but it also makes you want to write the next episode, the next book about it.
But Jane is not the only character in your books who has done this form of identity transference, for want of a different term. Jack Till did it in Silence.
Right, exactly, yeah. Jack Till is sort of the anti-Jane in this particular case because, he's a good character, too, meaning good versus evil rather than good meaning well-written.
Both. I'll go so far as to say they're both.
He takes he's a person who is a former policeman, and so he knows pretty much how the police go about looking for someone, and so he essentially saves a woman who has strong reasons to believe that she's about to be murdered. But years and years later, I don't remember how many years, it's like 7 years, I think, in silence, he realizes that he's got to go hunt her up again, go find her. And all he knows really anymore is how he had taught her to change her identity. And so that was sort of a fun thing. It was like unraveling a Jane Whitefield novel by pulling on a thread and pulling it apart.
Well, and in The Boyfriend, identity shows up in The Boyfriend, too, your most recent Jack Till, because the person that he's asked to look into this young woman's death, and it turns out she is not who her parents think she is. The other victims of this particular killer also share that.
Right. Well, Joey, who is the boyfriend, the killer, is doing something that I was sort of experimenting with and thinking about, and that is that if you're on the run, if you're trying to, maintain the lowest of low profiles, the very best way of doing it would be to never show up at all. He lives with young women that he seduces, essentially, and he becomes their boyfriend. And therefore, he's living in their apartment, which is under their name. And because he tends to choose women who work as escorts, what is going on there is that their name is probably not their given name either. They have a kind of stage name that they use for working. And so it would be, if anybody is trying to trace this person, the barriers would be impossible. They're just voids. They would find the name of some young woman and find out it wasn't even her real name. And then they would have to figure out that that he was living with them, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very difficult thing to find him. And so
I really felt Jack's pain during that, because it's, as the narrator, reading from the point of view of the narrator, you sort of see what's happening, but Jack isn't in that position, and you could feel his frustration. But he's a pretty bright guy, and he's helped people disappear, and I think that informed some of the story.
Yeah, he knows some things that the average person doesn't know, and he's also got certain qualities that I thought would be useful for this character. I mean, because the boyfriend, the person that he's up against, is truly evil, and is a really scary guy. And it's partly because of a kind of detached thoughtlessness that he doesn't think about what anything feels to anybody else, which is it's enormously liberating if you're a professional killer, but it's also one of the most chilling things that we encounter in real life. I mean, that's one of the things that I've sort of worked on for a lot of years, it's essentially trying to figure out what's really scary. And what's really scariest, I think, is these characters, these people who have absolutely no
sociopaths.
Ability to, there's no empathy. There's nothing there.
Sociopaths are scary, and especially ones that can sort of blend in, that aren't overtly crazy at first glimpse.
Right. Yeah, and there's also something that I picked up partly from experience and partly from a book called The Sociopath Next Door, which is quite an interesting book if you ever get a chance to read it. And it's, what it does is it shows that being a sociopath is a kind of continuum rather than a hard and fast definition. A lot of sociopaths are people who are completely harmless in terms of violence, but who simply care not at all about you. They care only about themselves. And so their sociopathic act might be an act of violence against you, but it might instead just be trying to persuade you to, you know, pay their rent for 3 months.
So you have the Jane series, and you brought the Butcher Boy back after almost a decade on The Lam and The Informant, and so I'm curious, will he be back, and are you also planning another Jack Till novel?
Well, the Butcher's Boy thing is kind of funny in a way. I did the first one when I was 30, and he was 30. He and I have always been the same age, roughly. And 10 years after that, I got kind of curious about him, because I thought, gee, you know, I'm 40 now, and I'm really a different person. I wouldn't pull that trick that he does where you take the shelf off of a closet in a hotel and use it to crawl from one balcony to another on the 10th floor of the hotel building. But I'm a lot better liar and a lot more cunning than I used to be. And I wonder what he'd be doing. And so I wrote about him 10 years later. And then 20 years after that, I did The Informant. So it's been a 30-year project in a way. And The Informant, when The Informant comes along, the Butcher's Boy, who's usually called Michael Schaefer, I fudged on his age. I made him about 50. That's, at this point, I aged faster than he did. But his nemesis, Elizabeth Waring, who was a data analyst in the basement of the Justice Department in the very first book, is now the highest-ranking civil servant in the Justice Department organized crime division, and has the corner office with the big windows. And so, you know, they're both coming after this situation much, much later. And that's fun. I mean, I was looking at it not only over a period of their lives, but over the period of my life. Everything that happens, in a sense, is looked at by a person who's their age each time. I think I may bring Jack Till back sometime, but he's not as urgent. I think the reason I brought him back in A Boyfriend was just that novel was ice cold. It was one of those stories where, you know, everything was kind of hard and violent and uncaring, and so I needed somebody like Jack Till to be the detective, because, you know, he's somebody who does things because he really cares about people.
He has a strong sense of duty too. He has this, you know, in the story about his daughter and being a single parent, it comes through that he is a man of integrity and a man who is committed to his family and doing what's right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you can imagine that book without Jack Till, you know, you can see why I brought him back. You know, the events would just be frightening and depressing without any kind of resolution ever.
You know? Although he's a great, you know, he's a great guy to spend some time with. I mean, he's, you know, because although he's a good guy, he's also, he's not a saint. You know,
he's a guy.
He's a guy, and you know, he's just a very interesting character, and he's very smart. And, you know, he knows when to play, he knows how to negotiate with people, and it's just to me, Jack Till is a very real kind of person, you know, a former policeman who's gone private. you were born in upstate New York and now you live in Southern California. And mm-hmm. you have one series, Jane Whitefield, which takes place in northwestern New York State. And Jack Till is based in L.A. And the Butcher Boy is here, there, and everywhere. And your standalones are often in Los Angeles. Is it easier to write? Do you think that the location informs the story? Which side of the country makes an easier setting for you to write about?
Well, it sort of depends on what's going on. I think, you know, Buffalo has the sort of Buffalo area, you know, where I grew up, has a kind of special set of symbolic meanings for me. I think a lot of the time, if I look back on books that I've written in which somebody goes there, usually they're going there because it's a refuge for them. They're getting away from something or other temporarily. And I think, you know, in a sense, you know, that's in some deep psychological sense, that's home for me. You know, that's mm-hmm. where I grew up, and that's where my, you know, parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and everybody were. And so, you know, I think that it sort of automatically comes up as a possibility. But at the same time, there are certain things that happen that you want to have happen in your books that require a larger city. You know, they require a place like Los Angeles where you can, you know, kill somebody and get on a freeway and be 15 miles away in 10 minutes.
This is a perfect segue to talk about Metzger's dog.
Wow, okay. Well, good.
Because I started to reread it, and I haven't finished it, but I've skipped through. I think it is probably, and it was written in 1983, am I correct?
So, probably 1982, because they always, you know, there's always that 8 or 9 month lag before they actually come out.
So 30 years ago, you know, it was pre-internet and pre-cell phone and before the digital revolution, you know, the widespread use of the digital revolution. It is probably the most subversive book I can think of that I've ever read. What they do to the freeway system in Los Angeles. So I see what you mean. That really wouldn't work in Buffalo.
No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't. Everything in Buffalo is 15 minutes from everywhere else, and you can get there in several different ways. But yeah, Los Angeles is it's the ultimate modern city in all of the good and bad senses. You know, its complexity is a wonderful thing, and at the same time, it makes it fairly easy to, let's say, turn it all into a tangle and a mess.
But just, you know, I often think about that, and I've thought about that for years. You know, what was Chinese Gordon and Margaret do to these freeway intersections and freeze up the city? And every time I hear, for those of you listening that don't live in Los Angeles, we have a thing called a SIG alert. Every time I hear a SIG alert and I hear how it radiates out, I think of your book. I think of how they froze the city. And I can't help but wonder if you didn't receive visits and phone calls from law enforcement asking you, where did that come from? And don't ever do that again.
No. Well, actually, I have had both kinds of reactions from law enforcement. I've had officers in uniform come and talk to me at book signings and say, you know, I did something just like that. You know, I was undercover, and this is what happened. At the same time, the things like, I don't know, the tangle on Metzger's dog is mostly just amusing to people because, you know, it was 1983, and the thought that anybody would ever think to attack Los Angeles in any way for any reason was just not on our radar. We just didn't didn't think about it. You know, I was feeling, pretty original and groundbreaking when I was writing that stuff, and I was kind of laughing to myself as I was doing it. Well, you know, after September 11th, 2001, that attitude really vanished in me and probably in everybody else. I mean, I don't think, in fact, that if I were writing that a book like that now, that I would really be able to do it. I don't think it would be fun anymore.
No, I think you're absolutely right. The implications of something like that are horrifying. But when I read Metzger's Dog, it is refreshing. And please don't take this the wrong way. It's refreshing in its innocence. This is a fun story. It's a bit cloak and dagger, and yes, you know, it is a crime story, and people get shot, but things get covered up. But the idea that you could paralyze a city by dumping sand, it was just so funny in 1983. It's, you're absolutely right. It is, the idea of paralyzing the city is not funny now. And of course, that was also before the earthquake of 94, where we found out what it was like to live in a city that really was paralyzed.
Right.
And
exactly. And that these things, they do happen. And then after they happen, all of a sudden it's not a game. And, that is something that kind of limits our imagination and so on. And in this particular case, I don't think that there's anything in that book that, in a way, just the fact that it's now 32 years ago that I wrote that, there's, in a way, that historic distance makes it harmless in a way. You know, it's almost as though we're talking about a 19th century city. I mean, how do you, paralyze Richmond during the Civil War or something? Because the time makes such a difference now. But I do look at that book with great affection, and I remember it. Sometimes I smile. At that time, I was working at USC, and my wife was at home here in Studio City, typing her dissertation on an IBM Selectric. I don't know if you remember that those existed.
I do.
Well, it's funny. I went to a concert and they were doing that typewriter symphony or whatever occasionally they perform, and you hear the sound of the typewriter for the percussionist is doing that. And this was one of the Toyota Symphony presentations on Saturday morning for children, and so they had the percussionist get up and explain to children what a typewriter was and show them one, and then they played the piece. And anyway, my wife was at home typing her dissertation, working on it, and I would, while I was at work at lunches and sometimes very early in the morning, I would think of what the next part of Metzger's Dog was going to be. And I was driving the 110 and the 101 freeways every day and thinking about this stuff as I was in my daily traffic jam. And I would come home and I would actually write it. And I would leave the pages with her at night. And, you know, the next day I would go to work and I would come back and she would have typed the rest of the pages. And, you know, sometimes she would call me up in the middle of the day because she couldn't read my handwriting or something. But otherwise, everything went exactly like that. And when it was done, I sent it to Scribner's. And it was published just about the way it is now. It's practically a first draft novel. It's the only time that ever happened to me. And, I don't know whether she was correcting the mistakes and, you know, while she was typing it or whatever. But that was the easiest novel I ever wrote in my life. I think that, you know, we have a great deal to thank the computer for. But there's one thing that, you know, the sort of the ability to type out and send out the ill-considered and unpolished has not served us well. So for that reason, I still write my first drafts in longhand and then type them into the computer afterwards. And Yeah, it keeps me honest. It makes sure that I do the proper number of drafts and go over it the proper number of times before I, you know, attempt to send it to.
Tell me what you have planned for 2015. Are we going to see another novel?
I just sent the I can't call it the first draft, but let's say I sent the new manuscript to my editor, Otto Penzler, at Mysterious Press, Grove Atlantic, a new novel, which is a standalone, and it takes place in Los Angeles, and, well, I really can't say much more than that. I shouldn't. So,
can you,
it's all new characters, and...
Does it have a working title?
Yeah, the working title that I have for it is 40 Thieves, but my titles seldom survive sales meetings. So my titles are always, in a sense, working titles or first drafts or something like that. You know, the number of times in which, you know, they'll have a sales meeting somewhere and I'll get the word back, you know, nobody likes your title. So...
Well, you know, I guess it's all part of the business of getting a book out the door and into the hands of your fans. But I'm thankful that there will be another one next year.
Well, thank you. There will be if Otto likes what he reads this weekend. But anyway, it is done and it will probably see the light of day. You know, I did enjoy it. It's a little bit lighter than some of the ones that I've been writing recently. And, so it'll be, I hope, a pleasure for people to read.
Well, I, for one, am looking forward and hope that you'll agree to come back on the podcast when that one's released.
Sure, I'd be delighted.
And I've taken up enough of your time, and I want to thank you so much for being on the show. And I wish you a very happy holiday. This will be broadcast after the first of the year to coincide with the pub date of A String of Beads, but it's before Christmas right now, so Merry Christmas.
Yes, and same to you. And, I'll be looking forward to talking to you again.
In the coming weeks, Speaking of Mysteries hopes to have, in addition to Joe Perry talking about Dead is Better, Michael Cardos speaking about his new mystery, Before He Finds Her, as well as Alexandra Sokoloff talking about Huntress Moon, the first book in a trilogy. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening.